KIOS FM presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear the 9th Annual Governor's Lecture in the Humanities, presented by the Nebraska Humanities Council. This program was recorded on Thursday, September 9th, 2004, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speaker will be American journalist and historian David Halberstam, author of The Making of a Quagmire, America and Vietnam During the Kennedy Era. He'll speak on the topic War and the Modern Presidency. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Nebraska Humanities Council, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Nebraska Governor Mike Johanns.
Mr. Halberstam is an award-winning journalist and a historian whose books and articles have traced American life from the battlefield to the ball field. He is as well known for his books on the Boston Red Sox and Michael Jordan as he is for his political histories. With his best-selling trio of books, The 50s, The Powers That Be, and The Reckoning, Mr. Halberstam traced the history of post-World War II America and gained recognition as one of the nation's most insightful writers on the United States during the last half of the 20th century, the American century. In addition to domestic issues, his vision of modern U.S. history is focused on the larger international dimensions of American politics. Two of Mr. Halberstam's most acclaimed works, The Best and the Brightest and War in a Time of Peace, trace the impact of international conflict on the legacies of four American presidents, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, the first George Bush, and Bill Clinton. In this age of heightened international awareness, and in this season of political wrangling as we approach the presidential election, I am very confident you will find Mr. Halberstam's perspective to be not only intriguing, but very engaging. Ladies and gentlemen, it is now my pleasure to present David Halberstam speaking on war in the modern American presidency. Please help with a Nebraska welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Governor, and thank all the people who've been so gracious to me all day. A few years ago, just before the start of the millennium, I gave a series of lectures about where America was and the main forces changing it and challenging it. And the most important at that time, of course, was the end of the Cold War and a belief that so much of the newly liberated energy and financial resource could now be used for domestic purposes. And I spoke about any number of new forces, the change in my lifetime from when I was in college, from a one-income middle class to something new with both pluses and minuses, the two-income middle class, with both parents working and having less and less time for children, people working harder and harder just to stay where they were in the middle class. I mentioned the profound change in the nature of work from the 50s, from work driven by blue-collar muscularity when I was young to work as it is today, increasingly driven by education and without muscles, a workplace where a 110-pound young woman with a college degree can do better than a 200-pound high school graduate football player who wants a job on the Ford or the GM line, except that those jobs are essentially gone. And I mentioned the Allied issue. something that has considerable impact on the rise of cultural rather than economic issues, because so many men, young men today, feel that they are not doing as well as their fathers and are not as influential at home as their fathers were. And that the decline of blue-collar jobs, of course, had immediate political impact, though not necessarily in the way that we might expect. Many of the men who've been squeezed out of what they feel is their proper place with proper rewards in the economy do not necessarily take their place with the Democratic Party, the party generally of those with the larger economic grievance. Instead, they see the change as one wrought not by technology but by politicians, and they see the Democrats as the party of politicized women. And in the conflict between economic and cultural interests, they do not necessarily base their political allegiance on economic interest. I think one of the most important political statistics of the last 12 years is that Bill Clinton twice and Al Gore once, in terms of the popular vote, had a majority of the popular electorate, but in all three elections, the Democratic candidate had a minority of white male votes. That's something radically different from the voting patterns of my youth. I spoke as well at the turn of the century about the coming of a new, increasingly non-white America, very different from that of my childhood in the 30s and 40s, and the great new influx of Hispanic Americans, not just in the South and Southwest, but throughout our entire country. I did not, but probably should have, speak of the impact of this and other racial issues on our tax base, with the growing reluctance of those who constitute an older white America to pay certain taxes that they believe will go primarily to help, education is a good example, these newer Americans. Thus, we have become a much harder society to tax, and thus the rise of something that is really inconceivable when I was young, the state-sanctioned casino open to collect badly needed taxes. I mentioned what I thought was our greatest strength as a society, in addition to our inherent social fluidity, our magnificent upper educational system, not just the great schools of the Ivy League and Stanford and Cal and Chicago, but our great land-grant universities, the university where we are tonight, the Big Ten schools, California alone, the nation of California, the Route 128 around Boston, the nation of Boston. This allows us to be, more than anything else, resilient and regenerative, to stay on the cutting edge scientifically and economically. We are, in that sense, a beacon, nothing less, to the rest of the world. We are not just an economic and a military superpower, but perhaps most important of all, an educational superpower, something that allows us to renew our strength again and again. It is one of our greatest blessings. But I mentioned as well our weakness in K through 12, that I felt in all too many venues we were slipping and that we were losing far too many kids at too young an age, American kids, and that this was undemocratic and almost anti-American, that there was in fact some considerable rot in our essential educational foundation. And when I think about the gap in education at this elemental level between what my daughter and I suspect the children of most of you are privileged to enjoy and what so many other less fortunate American children face, I am reminded of one of John Kennedy's best sentences: if we cannot help the many who are poor, how can we save the few who are rich? I mentioned that when I was in college, post-World War II, class lines in that blue-collar era were dropping and more people were coming into the middle class. But that now I feared they might be on the rise, lines driven by education, access to college education and elite education, and that education was becoming potentially too expensive for those who did not get it, and if they did not get it, could not make their way in this increasingly sophisticated society. And finally, I mentioned a world of Islam aflame, angry over its fall centuries ago from greatness, explosive and dangerous, futile in many ways, but with access to the most modern instruments of communications with which to fan its feeling of grievance. And you cannot imagine a more terrifying combination, a feudal society with modern communications. I suggested that a critical part of our policy towards that part of the world was that we not become the lightning rod for their anger, so much of it ill-defined and poorly focused. I did not, in those speeches, mention terrorism. Like everyone else, I was way behind the curve. And then came September 11th, and we all, obviously, in retrospect, should have seen it coming or something like it coming. Let me suggest that the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon ended a unique historical span for us as a great power, one that I would place at nearly a century, or perhaps 87 years to be a little more exact, a period in which America has been a major player in the world, but has been given at least a partial immunity from the ravages of modern warfare and weaponry because of its sheer combination of its unique geographical position and the sheer force and magnitude of its almost unparalleled industrial and technological base. It has taken a group of rebels without a country, a ghost nation that is their particular strength, to become a threat to us. In that nearly nine-decade period, the immense carnage of the modern era was always somewhere else. We were therefore permitted many illusions, some of them existing long after it was obvious that those illusions were in fact just that and were no longer valid. We became, in no small part because of our geography and our power as that 87-year span continued, somewhat schizophrenic, a curious blend of innate isolationism, a factor of our two great oceans, our size, richness, and self-sufficiency, combining with the quite involuntary role of being the richest, most powerful nation in the world, a democracy sworn not just to protect our own freedoms, but to shield, in a shrewd estimation of our enlightened self-interest, like-minded democratic regimes. Yet true internationalism has always been a somewhat uneasy role for America. What a curious, contradictory country we are. So much of the rest of the world sees everything we do as imperialist, and yet we have an isolationist soul. Our isolation, which was physical in one era, clearly ended a long time ago, but it nonetheless remains a critical part of our outlook, a formidable undertow to the new reality of this modern age, more psychological than physical now, more a hope than a reality. Our geography, therefore, has always dominated our national psyche. We are by instinct apart from Europe, and we quite like being apart from Europe. We have a complicated love-hate relationship with internationalism. That world of innocence, of an America immune from its enemies, is past. The terrorists have found us before we found them. They were at war with us before we were at war with them. It had been coming a long time, but getting America to change larger foreign policy eras, Cold War to modern terrorism, is a slow one, not unlike trying to steer an aircraft carrier by trailing your hand behind it in the carrier's wake. The educational or re-education process in a country as big as this, from one foreign policy to an era to another, is a painful one. I think you can look at the recent 9/11 report that Tom Kane and Lee Hamilton, two of our best public citizens, just did as a primer on how and why a great country was so unprepared, and see it as a critical step in an educational process that should have started 20 years ago. But that, note, without the success of the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, we would have never paid any attention to the report, and we wouldn't have summoned Tom Kane and Lee Hamilton to do it. And if they'd done it, we'd have buried it. I want to say here that I support the president and the administration in his attack on al-Qaeda. Dealing with terrorism will be one of the central parts of the remainder of our lives and our children's lives. The ability to maximize personal security for all Americans while not trampling, this is so important, not trampling on the essential constitutional protections of ordinary Americans. For the first time, when we talk about having enemies within, as J. Edgar Hoover did years ago, we really do have enemies within. And then came Iraq. These are somber words. I really regret having to come here in so somber a tone, but I think it's important to talk as candidly as I can. There'll be plenty of others who will be more optimistic, I am sure. About 10 months ago, the people who run the John Kennedy Library in Boston asked me to come and do a lecture on Iraq and Vietnam. I held them off for several weeks. Didn't want to do it. Didn't want to open that door again. My life and my work go exceptionally well these days. I'm finishing a book, my 20th, that I care deeply about, on some critical battles in the Korean War. When the Chinese crossed the Yalu undetected and caught our forces up near the Yalu unaware, a mere 300,000 of them crossed undetected, another great intelligence failure. And so I did not want to enter another ugly battle like the one I went through back in the 60s over Vietnam when I was a young reporter for the New York Times filing pessimistic dispatches, and two presidents, both John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, attacked me. President Kennedy asked the publisher of the New York Times to transfer me to Saigon, and Lyndon, out of Saigon, and Lyndon Johnson, taking time from his heavy duties as President of the United States to double as Minister of Truth and Patriotism, called me and my young colleague Neil Sheehan traitors to our country. Comparably lower-level working people at the Pentagon and State Department lined up to take shots at us. Time magazine ran two poisonous, lethal press articles excoriating me and various other journalists, most of whom had never been to Vietnam, attacked me and my colleagues. They attacked my patriotism, my honesty, my loyalty, and even my manhood. It was not fun. I was 28 and 29 at the time. President Kennedy said I was probably too young to be there, and then someone noted that his youngest brother was a year older and had just run for the Senate and won in Massachusetts. At one point, because we took patriotism very seriously in my family. One of my colleagues came in one day and said they're having a hard time over at the embassy. And I said, why? And he said, well, they apparently did some covert checking on you, wanting to get at you through your family, and they're very unhappy to find out that your father went into World War I as a private and as a medic, came out as a sergeant, and went back in World War II as a surgeon, and came out as a lieutenant colonel. It doesn't help them in blackening your reputation. In time, all of this swung around, these attacks. Our reporting was validated by events and by senior military people writing their memoirs. There's really not much difference from my memoir, from some of my reporting, than, for example, Colin Powell's memoirs. Other Army officials said that we, rather than the government, had been telling the truth. More recently, a new edition of The Best and the Brightest was issued by the Modern Library, with John McCain writing the introduction. For me, that was a great tribute, and it's like coming full circle. So I did not want to go there again. I did, however, because I think it's important to talk as candidly as we can about Iraq and try and get some historical perspective. And also because as things began to look grim in Iraq a few months ago, my phone started ringing from various news organizations wanting to know if there was a Vietnam-Iraq connection. I was going back up on the Rolodexes of the people who place guests on talk shows. And so the answer is, on Vietnam and Iraq, there is a connection and there isn't. There is a similarity and there isn't. And the parallel may be more about the way we behave than in the similarities between the two countries. I'm going to go back now and use some of the things I said in lectures and talks before the invasion of Iraq, because I feel it's important to point out that these are not ex post facto views fashioned once it became clear that we had bogged down into something very dangerous there. I was cautionary before the combat troops went, and I remain cautionary now, and I remain somber as well. I am very aware that there are vast differences between Vietnam and Iraq, that the dangers posed in each case are very different. I know the vast differences between Ho Chi Minh, who is in no way a threat to us, and Saddam Hussein, who in many ways fits the definition of evil. And I know that Iraq and Vietnam are in some ways apples and oranges, and it's a danger to overstate the similarities. But there are parallels, and sometimes some of the apples seem like oranges and some of the oranges like apples, and that there are increasing signs that we are now being challenged by a genuine urban insurgency, and even more that our objectives are not necessarily the objectives of large numbers of Iraqis. These are a few of the points that I made before we invaded. First, that we were about to punch our fist into the largest hornet's nest in the world, and that the consequences would be vastly different from what we expected. The people there might hate Saddam Hussein, but for a variety of historical and cultural and religious reasons, we would not be welcomed as liberators. I believed as well that we were in an unseemly rush to go to war, and that we badly needed more allies, more international support, and greatly better intelligence. I was made very uneasy by the lack of intelligence. And I thought that we had too much confidence in our pure military superiority and were probably quite unaware of our political weaknesses. I believe that our leadership had gravely underestimated the capacity of the other side to resist once the first military phase was over. We would, with our brilliant, and I mean truly brilliant, high technology, military technology, and our extraordinary young men and women with their, I mean, I don't know how much time you spend around the young people of, or in the leadership of the American Army these days, but it is in all ways superior, not just the Army, the American military, that we would do the first part quite well, the race to Baghdad, but that the second part would be about urban guerrilla warfare in terrain more favorable to the other side, their terrain, their timetable, their language, their indigenous people, and I feared their ability to nick our kids, nick away, two or three a day. I thought we were utterly ill-prepared for it and that it was likely to be stage two. I believe that when that mission accomplished sign went up on the aircraft carrier today, it was like a baseball manager proclaiming victory in a baseball game with one out in the first inning, that this was just the beginning of a long, difficult, likely to be painful haul. I feared that in an urban guerrilla war, we would be in a very dangerous deficit intelligence situation. They would know, for obvious reasons, who we were at all time, identified by our uniforms and our skins. They would have the language we wouldn't. They would have, in effect, their racial profiling of us, while we would not know they were. That would put our young servicemen and women under unbearable pressure, it seemed to me, in situations which were beyond dangerous. I think one of the most interesting thing and something this difficult is how the restraint of our young people in such difficult, delicate situations. One of the things I had learned in Vietnam was that if you were doing what the indigenous people really wanted, you did not have an intelligence problem because they came to you. But if you were not tuned to their needs, you were likely to be very vulnerable. The movie they were watching in the White House and the Pentagon, I suggested, was Patton. And the movie they should have been watching was a movie called The Battle of Algiers, which, by the way, I would commend to any of you here tonight to see, by a filmmaker named Gilles de Pontecorvo, which is the story of the Algerian rebels and the French soldiers in the guerrilla war, urban guerrilla warfare, the Algerians waged against the French. By the way, a couple of months afterwards, they started showing the Battle of Algiers in the Pentagon. I believe then and now that the great intelligence fiasco is, oddly enough, not that of the weapons of mass destruction. I can think, actually, that that's understandable, although that I was distressed that the vice president went before a large veterans group 2 years ago and said that we had proof positive of these weapons of mass destruction. By chance, sitting in the audience that day was a General Tony Zinni, Marine four-star, two tours of duty in Vietnam, and up until very recently at that moment, commander of CENTCOM, which, as you probably know, includes Iraq, and where, because we were on the very threshold of war, he most seriously studied every day whether there was proof of weapons of mass destruction. And he had seen no evidence at all, nothing definitive. And he was furious with Mr. Cheney's claim. He believed, as he has said publicly again and again, that the vice president was lying. Mr. Cheney, it turned out, had made that claim because only a few weeks earlier, Brent Scowcroft, whom I consider one of the small handful of truly distinguished Americans to play such a role in the NSC over the last 60 years, had come out against an Iraqi adventure because Mr. Scowcroft had seemed to be joined at the hip to the senior George Bush. They had done George Bush's presidential book together, alternate pages, really, what Scowcroft had said was very important, and Cheney wanted to stop Scowcroft's influence within the high bureaucracy, and he did, albeit, it seems to me, at a very high price. By contrast, since I don't think the weapons of mass destruction is the great miscalculation, I believe the great one is the idea that we would be treated as liberators. A fatal mistake if you see now that our troops are under attack from the very forces that they were in so many cases supposed to have liberated. How the intelligence agencies failed to send up red flags on this most elemental and fateful question is beyond me. Not that I believe that it might have made that much difference, because I believe that all too many people at the highest level of the administration were determined to push ahead from the moment that 9/11 took place. In some, as in Vietnam, I believe we overrated our allies and underestimated the forces against us. We overestimated the value of our great, great military superiority and underestimated the importance and influence of our political weaknesses and vulnerabilities. I also felt that by doing Iraq, we would take valuable resource away from our real enemy, Al-Qaeda, as Richard Clark, the top person on terrorism, has since suggested. And I believed as well that it might put the government of Pakistan, our most important ally in the war against Al-Qaeda, under unbearable pressure. And it's quite possible that might be true, and it's quite possible that I am wrong on that. I know that, as in many ways, this is a very difficult and dangerous era in which to conduct foreign policy. More complicated, surprisingly, more dangerous, I believe, than the Cold War, when our deterrent and that of the Soviets made for a mutual and, in effect, equitable stalemate. Instead, some chickens have come home to roost after a very long time. The number of nations with atomic weapons grows, some of them rogue nations. The adversaries are, in some cases, not people with comparable cities and comparable armies, but, as I suggested, terrorists, part of a ghost nation against which our traditional sources of power are not applicable, at least in the short term. An era like this, with Islam aflame, demands wisdom and patience. Patience and wisdom. The contrast, it seems, between this administration and that of the senior George Bush is quite striking. The size of the coalition, the number of Arab flags, the respect for indigenous feelings. The great danger now, because of the rage in the Islamic world and the power of modern communications, is that we may be doing Al-Qaeda's recruiting for them. Historically, the most important lasting aspect of this war, the most important historical change, may be the fact for the first time that the Arab world is getting its news of a war like this, Christian, essentially white forces against Arabs, live and in color each night with Arab commentators. I do not think, as we get our own versions of events each night, we realize how devastating a change that is on the other side of the world, that this is a sea change in a kind of communications division. I should note that the doubts I had about Iraq were shared by many senior officials in the uniform military. They had spent time in Vietnam, and they were warier about the use of power in a situation like this, fearing the moment when your pure military superiority, the ability to win any set-piece battle, is undermined by your lack of political appeal, as if there is a tipping point. In Vietnam, we had absolute military superiority, but the other side had absolute political superiority. In the end, we ended up fighting the birth rate of the nation. In Vietnam, I felt we entered in the embers of a colonial war. You know how America is. We went there for the first time in combat readiness in 1965, and we believed that the Vietnam War began when we got there. We did not really realize that it had been going for 19 years from 1946, when Ho led the uprising against the French, that they had a history that we did not choose to envision. We subtracted that. We subtracted the importance of the French Indochina War from our perception of the political military reality. In effect, as we made our calculations, we deprived them of their own recent history. In Iraq, I think, again, we have discounted the importance of a colonial past and of the resentments of the Islamic world against the West when we planned this invasion. It's all too easy in this part of the world, no matter how benign your military attention is, to become the enemy. That's what I meant when I said punching our fist into the largest hornet's nest in the world. And I am deeply saddened by this tragic miscalculation of using our force where there is so much doubt about its application. I believe that it has made the real job stamping out Al-Qaeda and its parallel terrorist groups all the more difficult. I think we are more isolated from our allies, more isolated from the rest of the Arab world, and we are far more involved as a lightning rod for grievance in an Islamic world that was already afire, a target not just for the terrorists, but for so many others who are angry over that region's multiple political, economic, and educational miseries. I believe the war against terror is a very real one and an extremely difficult task, because the enemy is so elusive and because our deterrents are so hard to apply there. What I feared for a long time, as this began, is a long-range struggle that places us in ever greater confrontation with angry young protesters from the Islamic world, and seems to allow for less and less middle ground. That's a great danger, that all their misery will be focused on us, as if everything that goes wrong in their part of the world is our fault. Tonight, a number of people have come to me and quoted my distinguished colleague Tom Friedman, who said before the invasion, he talked about the consequences if we went into Iraq, and he said it's like going into a china shop. If you break it, you own it. Well, I'm afraid it's broken, and I'm afraid that, like it or not, if we don't own it, we've got to do something about piecing it together. And that's going to be harder than Vietnam. This is harder than Vietnam. The Vietnamese, I believe, never wished us badly as a nation. All they wanted for us to do was to go home, just like the French. There was no danger of them following us, no Vietnamese terrorist threat to us back in the States. But this is different. This is the real enemy. Some of them will follow us home, or at least try. Any weakness shown there will encourage those who wish us ill to be emboldened. We are going to need all the help we can get from old allies, from the UN, in trying to find some way to piece together a country that was never a country, and find some kind of decent way of getting out. Back in 1965, when George Ball was the number two man at State and doing his Dove papers trying to keep us out of Vietnam, he used a line from Emerson to begin them. And I use this sometimes in my speeches before. we went into Iraq. Events are in the saddle and ride mankind. And what he meant was that powerful men think they are in control of events, and they make one of their moves, and it turns out someone else has made a counter move that they hadn't thought of. And somehow events take over with their own dynamic. And as I say, I used that before the invention, and I'm afraid it's all too true today. Events have their own terrible consequences and their own orbital thrust. If these are somber words, let me suggest that I have great faith in American democracy. I'm a child of World War II. I'm a child of the Depression. I've seen the resilience of this country and its good nature and its strength come to the fore again and again. I believe that we are the most resilient of societies, and I believe that at some time in the future we will need all of our strength, resilience, and wisdom, for we are entering the most difficult foreign policy assignment of my lifetime. And the great challenge to our leadership is to be wise, to involve others, old allies, even the UN, though many find the UN an alien place. And finally, the great challenge to American democracy to remain fair, just, and tolerant as we enter a new and anxious era. Thank you very much for having me here tonight.
Thank you very much, David. The first question, David, is what is the responsibility of a conscientious news media in reporting and analyzing modern warfare, and how has it changed since Vietnam?
Well, I think the obligation is to be fair, be independent, to not be prisoner of your own myths, or your government's myths, to be respectful of them, but to be as independent as possible. It seems to me that there are times when journalism really matters, and one of them is in something like this, because the government is always going to blend its version with policy and politics. When I ran afoul of the Kennedy administration in 1963, it was not that there was really any doubt about the truth of what I was saying. It was that the president was beginning to gear up for a race. He thought it would be Barry Goldwater, and the last thing he wanted was a foreign policy failure on his hands. He wanted to keep Vietnam, I think, on the back burner, and here was this impudent young reporter at a time when the New York Times was more powerful, more influential than it is now. It's plenty influential now, but it was more so then because network TV was really in its childhood. It was embryonic. In fact, while I was there in Vietnam, it went from 15-minute show Huntley, Brinkley, Cronkite to 30 minutes. They didn't have color. They didn't have satellites. So Times was really very important. Here was I saying that he was quite possibly on his way to a first-class foreign policy failure, which affected the political equation, I believe they thought, of 1964. So the government's view is always going to be tailored to what the government has said is going to happen and to its desire, any administration's desire to run against. So more than anything, where young men and women's lives are at risk in something like this, there is an obligation to be respectful of the government, but to be independent. It's much harder these days. This is a much harder thing. The security is extremely limited for reporters in Iraq. It's very, very dangerous for them there. In general, there's been a slippage in the networks. They really, unlike the 60s and 70s when they were in their glory days, I think all three of the old ones, CBS, NBC, and ABC, really want to get out of the news business. They're giant corporations, and they've cut back on all kinds of foreign reporting. In addition, the coming of the Internet and CNN and MSNBC, this instant putting of something on the wire, getting it on quick, has diminished what I would call the verification process. I mean, the instinct, get first, be first, be first. And that is not necessarily the quickest way to great reporting. You know, you will remember there was a touch of that in the Atlanta Olympics when that poor sort of dopey kid, a bomb went off and they arrested a sort of dumb, not very smart kid who was sort of in the wrong place at the wrong time. And everybody went with it and went with his name, and they were all wrong. And that was a very good example of the breakdown of the verification process, because if one of the new networks puts it on, nobody wants to be second. So it's changed. When I was in Vietnam, we really had time to go out and do the reporting and verify, and it was dangerous, but it wasn't as dangerous as this. But the obligation is an old and abiding one, to go out, get it right, make sure to be the eyes and ears of serious lay people back at home, to tell them the things they need to know. I was, you know, when I heard, I was out in Vietnam, and I heard that President Kennedy had told the publisher he wanted out, it never bothered me. I mean, I knew that I was locked in, that I had great sources. My sources were five or six Americans, colonels who were division and corps advisors. I had friends down to battalion level. I had, as my friend Neil Sheehan did, we had a lock on it. And I didn't really care whether the president liked it or not. My job, I thought we were losing the war, was that my readers not be surprised if the other side walked into Saigon one day. My job was, I thought it was an act of patriotism. I was always, in my innocence, surprised that there were these attacks upon me for not being patriotic, because I thought telling the truth and swimming against the current was, in fact, an act of patriotism.
Do you think the Western press is doing its job in asking sufficiently tough questions of the administration?
I think the networks have been just much weaker in general, though, as I said, in the last 10 or 12 years. I think bosses want to get out of the news business. I think they're caught up in sex scandal, celebrity. I think one of the profound changes that took place in the networks is the coming of cable, and cable shows started doing things in order to get one point in the rating, and those shows were much more about sex, celebrity, scandal, more salacious. And as they did that, the network's share of the audience dropped, and they began to adjust their value system and I think adjust it downwardly. So I think they've been a loss from the days that I thought they were doing their best work. I think there's a moment, I think 9/11 jarred the country. And it's the first time really bombs had gone off in this, you know, we were immune in World War II. I think the Japanese got some dinky little bomb maybe there by a one-man submarine or something floated over in a balloon. If you think about bombs done in this country, they were done at our own hand in Oklahoma by people who thought that the FBI was the enemy. What an irony of that. So that the idea of people, terrorists, who could do this kind of act and seem to have escalated their abilities and have this kind of muscularity was really shocking, and it worked against the Democrats in Congress. It made them defensive and put them on their back heels, and I think it did to some degree with the media as well. The media in Washington tends always to reflect the givens of Washington. In Vietnam, if you think back to it, there, my colleagues and I in Saigon were really very independent of events there and quite pessimistic in our reporting. But our colleagues from the same newspapers and magazines in Washington tended to reflect each institution's view. A reporter tends to take on the coloration of his or her institution. And there aren't that many reporters in Washington who are that willing to stand apart, just like there's not many baseball players who are traveling with the team each day who are willing to anger the manager, the owner, and most of the players. There's a sense of being brought in. That's all. There's a kind of almost unconscious trade-off for access. That's why your better reporting tends to come out of a place like Iraq. Someone like John Burns, who's a truly distinguished and courageous reporter who's been in places like this for the New York Times for the last 25 years. I don't know how he manages to do it. It's beyond me, his courage.
Do you think the embedded reporters were taken in the way you just described?
No. I mentioned earlier in the speech that I had moved up on the Rolodexes. I did really have one cameo on the Rolodexes early in the war because I was interviewed at the time of the embedded reporters in the New York Times, and I sort of said I was sympathetic to them. I thought it was a good idea. And I, thereupon, whenever somebody did embedded reporters, I would be asked to go on CNN or whatever. I became Mr. Embedded Reporter Authority. I thought the embedded reporters were really a very good idea because we had really draconian restraints in Gulf War I, which I thought were undemocratic. And here was this rather better thing. And actually, we've had embedded reporters before. We had embedded reporters in World War II, essentially. Ernie Pyle, the great legendary World War II reporter, would stay with a given unit for weeks at a time. A young, very distinguished colleague of mine in Vietnam, Jack Lawrence of CBS, did brilliant reporting from the Central Highlands under a thing called Charlie Company. He stayed with one company a long time. I thought that the embedded reporters would be there on the road to Baghdad, that their reporting would tend to show the government, our government side, and that it was working well, that this would annoy critics of the government, and all these things took place because they covered what we did best. Although I had great faith in the ability of ordinary American grunts and ordinary American journalists tell each other the truth, that when you share the dangers, people will tell you the truth. And there was some reporting even on the way to Baghdad that was quite independent. And then I thought once they got to Baghdad and the war got into its next phase, people criticizing the reporters would switch sides, that the criticism would no longer come from the liberal left critics of the war, but it would now begin to come from the administration, who thought they were covering negative things too much. And I think that's what happened. I think the embedded reporters was a legitimate part. I mean, you're doing something in war. You've got suddenly in an age of modern communications thousands and thousands of people who want to go aboard. How do you control it? How do you keep them from getting killed and wandering off the reservation and being their own worst enemies? I thought that was an absolutely legitimate use of for the military on something like this. I have no problem with it.
This is your last question, okay. And you have a choice as to which one you'd like
well,
to
I,
answer.
Well, should you choose it?
You'll have to pick. This is your area of expertise. Right. Will the Chicago Cubs ever win the World Series, or is this the Red Sox year?
Well, I think I can go two for two here. swing left, throw left. hurt my rotator the other day. But I thought the Cubs were really going to win it all this year. I looked at that. Pryor, Wood, Zimbrano, I thought, coming of age, and then they get Mannix, and I didn't see how anybody could stop them. But they, I mean, I guess, I don't know how many games between them at this point Pryor and Wood have won. Is it maybe fewer than 15? I don't know. But, I mean, I'm surprised. And they don't win the big games. You keep waiting for them to turn it on, and they don't turn it on. And meanwhile, the Cardinals, I mean, not only is it a murderous center of a batting order, I mean, Pujols and Edmonds and Roland, but, I mean, the pitching's been so much better than anyone expected. I mean, right now, they look like the best team in baseball by far. The Red Sox might just do it. They've gone out to California against a team with good pitching, and they've just, I think, won three in a row. It's hard to tell because I didn't see the late sports, but the Yankees have not had good starting pitching. One of the things that's wrong when you do it Steinbrenner's way increasingly is all free agencies, you're getting older pitchers, and sometimes those arms begin to get out. Mussina and Brown have really not been, I mean, a number of people have not been as good as they were supposed to. So the Red Sox are on a much better roll. Their fielding's better now. I don't know. I've been signing books to teammates all year saying, maybe this is the year, and I think my friends in New York, we live in New York, and I grew up in a part of Connecticut that was in the DMZ between Red Sox Nation and the Yankees, a little town called Winsted. My fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth grades produced two people who've probably been part of your lecture series, me and Ralph Nader. And so he was contentious then, too. Ralph's always been Ralph. Ralph has always won every argument. We're in the DMZ, so half the town would go to, under the Philip Winter bus, to go to the Yankee Stadium would be, Yankee fans and half Red Sox fans. And I had the first apartment we lived in was, my father was a doctor, was in the Bronx, so I grew up in the days of Henrik Keller and DiMaggio and those great Yankee teams. But my friends in New York believe that I have been traded, or maybe they've traded me to the Red Sox because my friends, because of the teammates, are now Dominic DiMaggio and Johnny Pesky and Bobby Doerr. We're doing some kind of show, a veterans baseball show in Las Vegas, I think, in late September, October. So I think I'd really sort of like the Red Sox to win. I think it'd be really kind of wonderful. I'd love a Cubs-Red Sox World Series. Thank you.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard the 9th Annual Governor's Lecture in the Humanities, presented by the Nebraska Humanities Council. Today's guest speaker has been American journalist and historian David Halberstam, author of The Making of a Quagmire, America and Vietnam During the Kennedy Era. He spoke on the topic, War and the Modern Presidency. This program was recorded on Thursday, September 9th, 2004, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jane Hood, Executive Director of the Nebraska Humanities Council, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.